wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO here in Portland, where the time is now 9:01, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgeridge, along with our engineer, Patsy Kullberg, bringing you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. We call this program the Old Mole Variety Hour after Karl Marx's use of the old mole as a symbol of the revolution, those forces from below that suddenly erupt in the polite gardens of the wealthy to expose the foundations of the society of gross inequality, how the wealth of the wealthy is extracted from the labor of the multitude by violence and subterfuge. The political scientist Jody Dean has written, "Capitalism is a system that takes away from the many and gives to the few. Today, no one denies the fact that some always lose in the capitalist economy. The system produces losers, the unemployed, the homeless, the indebted, the conned, the wiped out, the abandoned, the sacrificed. It runs on debt, foreclosure, expropriation, eviction, dispossession, destruction. Those are just other words for privatization." On today's show, we'll be looking at how capitalism's hijacking of our commonwealth bears on the conditions that lead to shooting rampages in schools, conditions like defunding public schools, neighborhoods and housing, not to mention the gun industry. We'll also discuss the essential roles of racism and guns in creating the wealth of this wealthiest of nations. We will be talking about a couple of movies coming soon to Portland about how ordinary people, particularly women, have fought back against institutions of entrenched power. So stay tuned and hang out with us on the left side of the political spectrum, a side rarely mentioned, let alone given real hearing in the commercial media. If you want to hear this show again or any part of it or recommend it to your friends, it will be available on the KBOO website in a day or two. That's kboo.fm, and use the search box to find the Old Mole Variety Hour. Well, yesterday, the Old Mole's Bill Resnick talked with Chicago teacher Sarah Chambers about gun violence and the Republican proposal to provide guns to teachers as a way of stopping shooters in the schools. Sarah Chambers is a leading voice in the Chicago Teachers Union. And here's Bill.
Hi, Sarah Chambers. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Sarah Chambers is a Chicago school teacher, a union activist, and a union that has gained enormous community support through their proposals, their actions. That's around their program to build the schools Chicago's children deserve, and Sarah has been important in those struggles and attempting to build those schools. So, Sarah, last week a deranged young man killed 17 of his classmates and teachers in a Florida high school, and that's, of course, the latest of a long continuing series of mass murders by young men shooting at schools, older men shooting up a gay bar, killing 70 people in Las Vegas at a rock concert. At each of these horrible events, the gun control force has called for action, like more background checks, banning assault rifles, many others. Politicians, of course, did a lot of hand-wringing, and the anti-gun control politicians repeated their mantra, "This is a time to mourn and help the bereaved, not to take hasty actions." The National Rifle Association, of course, repeated that, and also another one of their little mantras, "The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun." And they then proposed to deputize more people with guns. In fact, armed school teachers. That was a terrific idea, enthusiastically endorsed and often proposed now by our esteemed, all-knowing president. Anyway, Sarah, here we are early in this latest battle. There's really some promise now in stopping the NRA and changing things a lot. There's now a youth crusade to control guns and change the schools. Sarah, let's first talk about arming teachers and then get to what can be done, including in the school. Sarah, are you ready to go to school packing heat?
No, I don't know a single teacher who wants to carry a gun in the schools. This is a completely outrageous idea. The teachers are fighting against these policies. Our teachers' unions are fighting against these policies. As school teachers, we are there to build relationships with students, help students learn. Imagine the relationship you would build with a student if the student knew you had a gun on you. And a lot of us, we work, you know, especially in urban areas, we work with mostly black and brown students. What kind of relationship could you build with these traumatized students? They would then see teachers almost the same as police. I mean, it's a completely horrifying idea. And what we need in our schools is more social workers, more wraparound services, counselors. You know, right now in Chicago, we are actually fighting to get our police removed from our schools. We don't even want police in our schools, so why would we want to be armed ourselves? There are a lot of problems when there are guns in the schools with, you know, students being harassed, the students being racially profiled, and we'd rather have social workers and counselors helping students cope and get through the trauma that they see in their daily lives.
Yeah, and maybe lower class sizes so that the kids who are really troubled get a whole lot more personal attention from teachers who, after all, see them every day. It seems to me you exactly. really are doing sort of, in most schools, kind of child rearing that's much more than just learning the ABCs.
Yeah, in most schools, you know, we're not only a teacher, we're the nurse, we're the counselor, we're the social worker, because we are so short-staffed and we have massive class sizes. In Chicago, there are some class sizes that almost hit 50 students, even in kindergarten to second grade. Imagine that. I mean, they never have money for schools in our country, but they always have money for guns and wars. And that is not what's going to solve our problem. And in the schools, we see, too, that with the racial profiling, you know, more black students get suspended in our schools. And this is across the nation. This isn't just in Chicago. There's a lot of studies showing that black students are targeted more for discipline. And so imagine if teachers were armed, that could cause a lot of problems, you know, because there are some teachers who might have, just through living in society, have more racist viewpoints. I don't think any teachers should have guns.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Sarah Chambers, a Chicago teacher, about guns in schools. We've been discussing the school shootings, the Trump National Rifle Association proposal to arm school teachers. It's a terrible idea. Sarah, though arming teachers is not supported by most people who live in this country, you pointed out that the schools are already very high places of surveillance with police stationed in the schools, and there's really been little recognition or objection to the schools becoming ever more disciplinary and tough on children and securitized with surveillance equipment and harsh discipline. You told me yesterday, even in elementary schools in Chicago, now they have metal detectors.
Yes, in my elementary school where I worked for 8 years, they have metal detectors and cameras everywhere. So imagine being a little kid walking into your school and seeing that. I mean, that's really a terrifying thought. And yet we only had a social worker there a few days out of the week. And we had more security than social workers or counselors. I mean, it's completely ridiculous notion. You know, I see it as the militarization of our schools and turning schools into looking more like prisons. It's the school to prison pipeline, and you see this a lot more in the black and brown schools. On the north side of Chicago, where it's more white students, you would not see these metal detectors in elementary schools. And it's really unfair to the black and Latino students who have to deal with this. Instead of, you know, police officers, we've been pushing and we fought in our last contract. We want restorative justice coordinators who actually work with students to deal with conflict and who will do mediation circles and help students with coping strategies. That's what we're fighting for, to have that instead of police, instead of all these metal detectors and cameras.
Yeah, you know, there's one other, it seems to me, big issue, a longer-term issue about the schools, and particularly, in fact, almost for kids from poor families. And that's sort of the curriculum of the schools, mandated curriculum, like, for example, the U.S. history or Illinois history courses. I'm not sure if they're mandatory in Chicago. They were when I grew up. The curriculum is sort of propaganda for the United States and for the American dream being alive and well, that everybody can make it if they just try hard. And this is the freest and best country in the world and all the rest of it. And we're the leading democratic force on the entire planet. And you are so lucky to be an American. That's sort of the major themes of the U.S. history books as I've read the critiques of them. That's profoundly disabling, it seems to me, for poor kids because they're living, their parents have not made it yet. Their parents have had all the opportunities. And they pretty much know that their test scores are low. They keep going at these kids to improve your test scores. It seems to me it's a machine that tells kids they're not good enough and they're not going to go anywhere and their families aren't good enough. And that leads, it seems to me, either to depression or to a lot of angry behavior that ends up in various kinds of violence and trouble. Can you talk about that? Does that hypothesis make any sense?
Yes. I mean, we have a lot of students who are angry at how they've been treated in society, how their neighborhoods are treated. Because in Chicago, what we see is in the neighborhoods where Black and Latino students live, they're really cutting back on services in those neighborhoods. They've cut our mental health clinics in those neighborhoods, closed libraries, closed Black schools. Right now in Chicago, they are proposing to close more Black schools, even though a few years ago they closed 50 schools in mostly Black neighborhoods.
They're filling up the other schools. The class sizes are 50, I gather.
Yes, definitely. And they're privatizing the schools as well. And then the jobs, there's not jobs growing in those neighborhoods. It's growing in the white neighborhoods in some areas, but in those neighborhoods, the jobs aren't growing. The salaries are either going down or staying the same, even though the costs are rising for, you know, apartments and just general living standards. And so a lot of students are angry. They have a right to be angry at the current racist conditions we have because there's still a lot of systemic racism. And, you know, in our neighborhoods as well, in the Black neighborhoods, they're heavily policed. And
yeah,
so they have a fear of the cops. And Chicago a lot, we've had students who are shot by police. Laquan McDonald, which was a big news story a few years ago, he was a student who was shot in the back 16 times by police. And so these students have a right to be angry, and we should be teaching them to organize and fight back against the current conditions and to organize unions in their workplace and to fight for better wages and to fight for a higher minimum wage and social services. That's really what we should be teaching them. And a lot of the textbooks do not teach them that. They teach them the American dream. You just fight hard enough, you will do okay. And so that's why, you know, in my classes, I like to teach books like Howard Zinn books or the People's History of the United States.
Or the biography of Malcolm X and many others.
Exactly.
You know, just one parenthetical, not only are the schools being shut down and the clinics and everything, but there is no big groceries. There are no grocery stores with, in fact, fresh food in large neighborhoods. The banks have left. The pharmacies have left. What comes in, of course, is the plasma gathering places where you can give blood every month to get a few meals. And, of course, the liquor stores. And in a lot of the places, the police are not, in fact, there's no presence whatsoever. So some of the people in the area who are angry, they take it out on their neighbors, and there's no protection at all. It's a terrible scene, it seems to me. And now they want the schools to become these sort of mini security places.
And one issue I didn't bring up is I've heard from a lot of our Black teachers that they would be very concerned that if they did have guns and there was an issue that, you know, if police came in, that they could end up being targeted.
Oh, absolutely. Like Black undercover officers, you know, they take them on drug raids. And then, of course, when the undercover officer is running after one of the suspects, they're shot by the other white police, thinking, you know, all Black people running with a gun, well, you just shoot them, right? And indeed, for Black teachers, they know the thing to do is to keep their arms in the air at all times when police confront them. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Sarah Chambers, activist, union activist, social justice activist in Chicago, teaches in the black and brown schools for some time. Sarah, what's the solution? And there's a lot of solutions. Some of them, of course, are just gun solutions, but a lot of them are changing. Ultimately, we have to change the culture and economy of this city. Why don't you get into that, of this country?
First of all, you know, we do need stricter gun laws where, you know, if you have mental health issues, if you are a domestic abuser, you know, you've been caught abusing your partner, you shouldn't be allowed to get a gun. And that shouldn't be a big issue. These should be laws that should have been passed a long time ago. Also, you know, we need to fully fund our schools. You know, they have trillions of dollars for wars in this country, but they're starving our schools. Every single year, we have more and more budget cuts. And so we need smaller classes to help our students with trauma. We need social workers, wraparound services. And we also need more funding and services for our communities that have been starved, our Black and Latino communities. You know, we should have free health clinics. We should have more jobs going in those areas. We should have more libraries and those kind of services. But right now, they're all being cut. And to fund this, so people ask, you know, where do we find this money to fund these type of services? Well, first of all, you know, we should cut back on our war budget. We have the biggest war budget, you know, we've ever had. Also, we should tax the rich. You know, the rich, a lot of the rich people, they pay less taxes than some of our poorest people. And tax some of these companies like Amazon that are making billions of dollars in profits and they're paying their workers complete minimum wage they can't even live on. Well, tax these companies. And we see a lot of companies in the U.S. that they pay no taxes. In Illinois, we have many, many companies who make millions or billions of dollars who are paying absolutely no taxes. And so this would produce a lot of money for our neighborhoods. And we should tax, actually, Wall Street. So we're pushing in Chicago for financial transaction tax. That would put a 1 cent tax on every trade. And it would produce billions of dollars that we could use for our schools. So there's plenty of options of how we could actually fund social services, fund our schools, fund our neighborhoods. But right now we see with the Trump administration, and frankly, you know, we've seen over the years also with the Democrats that they are not funding our schools. They're just continually making cuts.
Yeah, it seems to me there's also a sort of a larger picture of what happens in this country. And most of the shooters, of course, have been sort of from struggling. They're all male and they're all white. That is the shooters, and they themselves are bitter and many angry at all sorts of things and somewhat and very deeply troubled. All families now are living very precariously. A lot of people fail. The drug companies are pushing their poison, and there's no country like ours that uses as many legal drugs, much less illegal drugs. And there's huge amounts of alcoholism as well, a lot of it hidden. It seems to me that a lot of people in this country, they're struggling, actually, in many ways. And in some ways, they're doing better, despite the fact that their lives are so precarious and the jobs are so terrible and they're being humiliated daily just by this notion that the American dream is available to all if you're just a decent person and work hard. It seems to me that we have to be thinking about the larger structure of this country and how it operates with regard to creating really good work. There has to be work in nurturing and work in helping people and working together to create a better society. In fact, we really should change policing radically so that our public safety people are not a lot of cops with guns and who see their job as sort of restraining all these evil people. They should actually be servants of the people, and they shouldn't have 20 and out where they serve their 20 years and then they get this huge pension and serve often in SWAT teams and other sort of high military efforts. It seems to me in the long run we have to look at a very different way of a very different sort of social system.
Yes, we need to see our schools. You know, we have children in our schools. We don't need to be arming more people. We need to be taking care of our children and providing them with more resources to learn. And really, I think we should be, you know, de-arming the police in our schools and in our neighborhoods, to be frank, and have stricter gun laws and provide more social services. And that's what we really need in this country, not more guns, because clearly that's not the answer, because we have the highest shootings, you know, really in the world. So
by a long shot.
Provide more funding towards.
Yeah, and of course, we're moving in on a third of the people in prison in the world are in the United States. I mean, it's a remarkable development. Well, Sarah, there's a lot of work for a lot of social work, justice work. We're not going to run out of struggles. Thanks a lot for talking to us, and keep up your good work.
Thanks so much for having me.
Right, so long.
The sun is setting on the century, and we are armed to the teeth. We're all working together now to make our lives mercifully brief. And school kids keep trying to teach us what guns are all about.
And that's Annie DeFranco with Armed to the Teeth, following Bill Resnick's and Sarah Chambers' conversation about guns and schools and the larger social issues that underlie not only the shootings that make the news, but the everyday violence of lives lived in oppressive conditions. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Much of the national conversation following mass shootings revolves around access to guns and possible legislation to limit who can get a gun and what kinds of guns. The National Rifle Association, of course, argues that the right to carry a gun is a sacred right, not to be abridged. Following the most recent shooting, the NRA's Wayne LaPierre claimed, quote, "The right to possess and bear arms is not bestowed by man, but granted by God." Well, how did gun rights become such a critical part of the far right's religious faith? Paul Jay on the Real News Network put this question to his guest, Professor of History Gerald Horn, and here is what Horn replied.
Well, it begins with European settlement in the 1600s. Recall that a number of the initial European settlers hailed from what is now Great Britain, and they were religious dissenters, as you well know. What you may not know is that many of these dissenters were actually theocrats. They came to what is now the United States with firmly held, even rigid, religious beliefs that basically ruled out the kinds of religious faiths that, say, the indigenous population wanted to practice. And then when there was the revolt against British rule in 1776, what happens is there is installed a so-called Second Amendment to the United States Constitution, which is now the fountainhead for this now religious devotion to gun rights. And you can't understand the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution without understanding that the settlers wanted to continue moving westward, seizing the land of the Native Americans and stocking that land with enslaved Africans to endure free labor. And that involved, as they saw it, arming the European civilian population. Since that time, particularly in recent years, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that there is an individual right to gun ownership, even though the much-debated Second Amendment speaks in terms of a well-regulated militia. And on top of that, you have a National Rifle Association, a gun lobby, which is highly funded, and in fact is only part of a well-funded firearms industry that includes private enterprise, which spends heavily in buying the affections and votes of elected officials such as Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. And if you mix all of those factors together, you begin to understand why we had this tragedy recently in South Florida and why it is likely, if not probable, that such tragedies will continue to persist.
Oh,
That, of course, is Youth of the Nation by P.O.D., following Gerald Horn's explanation of the place of guns in American history. Last Friday on KBOO, Annie Haynes reviewed Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz about her book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, and they go into this topic of guns and the creation of the nation in a lot more detail, and we'll link to that on the webpage for today's show. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Well, given the role of guns in the near extermination of the original peoples of this land and in maintaining the enslavement of millions of Africans and their descendants, the issue of race and racism naturally arises. So here is my commentary on the role racism played and still plays in the ongoing expansion of capitalism in the U.S.
Black people are not really black. White people are not really white. The words black and white applied to people do not mean what they mean when applied, for example, to the stripes on a zebra or to objects like coal and snow. The colors of people's skins vary on a continuum from almost black to very light shades of pink. The words black and white, together with red, yellow, and brown, are used to divide people into distinct social categories called races, with each race assigned a different status in social and economic life. How did this artificial way of categorizing and ranking people come to be? And why does it continue to exist in spite of all the political work done to challenge it over the past 60 and more years? Last month on the Old Mole, I argued that racism originated with slavery in the American South in colonial times as a way of preventing alliances between poor whites and African slaves, and it continues to function as what W.E.B. Du Bois called a psychological wage granted to whites. Exploited though they were and are by their employers, at least they are better than the once enslaved black people who continue to be marginalized and underpaid relative to whites. Racism is thus at the service of capital. It prevents working class solidarity and helps keep the costs of labor down. Today, I'd like to do more to show why racism is essential to capitalism. In this discussion, I will be drawing heavily on an article by political philosopher Nancy Fraser. Taken in abstraction from each other, capitalism and racism look like separate issues. Capitalists own and control wealth that can be made to grow by putting people to work, people who have no wealth of their own and who therefore have no choice but to sell part of their lives to capital. The capitalist pays the workers enough, in general, so that they can go on working, as well as support a family that will produce a continuing supply of workers. But after paying wages and other costs of production, there is a nice surplus left over for the capitalist, which he, or the corporation, can use to further expand production as well as to finance lives of luxury for themselves or their shareholders. The existence of distinct races of workers does not seem essential to this process. But capitalism did not just spring into being in Europe around 1500. Where did the initial supply of wealth that could be used as capital come from? And why was there a supply of workers who had to sell their labor power? It wasn't as if a few smart people decided one day to use some of their wealth to buy equipment and raw materials and advertise for workers. Nor did peasants and artisans just decide one day to go out looking for wage work. A major source of the initial wealth that became capital was the silver and gold, violently expropriated by Spain, destroying ancient civilizations and enslaving the natives. Then, when too many of the indigenous people died from disease and overwork, capitalists turned to enslaving Africans to work in the mines. In Europe, peasants were forced off the land and into wage labor when, with the help of the state, lands were enclosed for the profitable raising of sheep for the wool industry. And the nation that was to become the behemoth of capital, the U.S., was built on land and resources expropriated from its original inhabitants, most of whom were slaughtered and the rest confined to reservations. This confiscated land then produced great wealth for capital investment and the building of the nation, but not by employing workers to grow tobacco, sugar, and cotton, but by violently extracting the labor of people who had themselves been seized and transported from Africa. Yet all this time, the nation was claiming to be a democracy, the land of the free where all men are created equal. The only way to believe this was also to believe that all men meant only white men. America was thus constructed as a white nation, which meant that everyone else whose land and labor we were seizing was something other than American. Now, capital must always be growing. We see now that capital has two ways to increase itself. First, exploitation. Capital exploits wage labor. Labor creates more than it costs the capitalist to employ it, and that surplus adds to the pile of capital. But the other way is simply violent theft and seizure, what Nancy Fraser calls expropriation, in contrast to exploitation. The native landscapes where we now live, paying banks and landlords for the privilege, were expropriated, stolen from native people. The nation became wealthy and powerful in the 19th century through the expropriation of the lives and labor of enslaved Africans and their descendants. The ideology of racism, the supremacy of the white man, and the devaluation of blacks and indigenous people was inevitable and necessary to justify and explain this ugly reality, the reality of racial capitalism. But what about now? Now that the nation, that is, its owners, are rich, haven't we outgrown our need for racism? Let me quote Nancy Fraser. "No one doubts that racially organized slavery, colonial plunder, and land enclosures generated much of the initial capital that kick-started the system's development. But even mature capitalism relies on regular infusions of commandeered capacities and resources, especially from racialized subjects, both in its periphery and its core. Accordingly, expropriation has always been entwined with exploitation in capitalist society, just as capitalism has always been entangled with racial oppression." End of quote from Nancy Fraser. Well, regular infusions of commandeered capacities and resources, especially from racialized subjects. What does this academic language mean? It means that populations, masses of people whose skin color marks them as other than white, can be treated as if they did not have the rights to fair treatment that, at least in principle, white workers have. Besides the territorial conquest and enslavement of the past, there are more modern forms of expropriation: prison labor, transnational sex trafficking, corporate land grabs, foreclosures on predatory debt, think subprime loans, and segmented labor markets enabling employers to pay workers of other races less than a living wage, which is a way of stealing from them. So the claim is that racism and capitalism are entangled because capital always needs more than the profits it can get from the relatively honest bargain it makes with workers it pays for their labor. Capital also needs to steal, to seize, to expropriate. The category of race makes this possible. Quoting again from Fraser, "Race emerges as the mark that distinguishes free subjects of exploitation, that is, citizen workers, from dependent subjects of exploitation. Political powers support capital accumulation in part by fabricating at least two distinct categories, that is, races, of subjects, one suitable for expropriation, another for exploitation." End of quote. Racism and capitalism are two aspects of one system of domination, the system of racial capitalism. So the movements against racism and capitalism must be one united movement. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Yes, my skin is black, but that's no reason to hold me back.
Stop me now.
that's the Temptations, with a message from a black man, following my commentary, Capitalism in Black and White, here on the Old Mall Variety Hour. And now here's Annie Haynes again to remind us of what you can do to keep KBOO going and growing.
That's right. Thank you so much, Clayton. You know, it is so important to support the resources that support you. And right now we're asking you to help us build a city of media makers. That is, support KBOO through our Kickstarter campaign. We are live on Kickstarter, and you can find it at kboo.fm/Kickstarter. You can do that right now. And after you contribute what you can, please share that information in your feeds and let people know how exciting KBOO is as a community resource. Spread the word far and wide, because people can listen to our podcasts and listen to our FM signal stream on our website, kboo.fm, no matter where you are. So you can get the insightful commentary of the Old Mole Variety Hour and all of the other amazing public affairs programs that are homegrown from volunteers, from community members here in our own backyard in the Willamette Valley, and reaching really global issues around the world. We need your support to continue it. That's Kickstarter. You can find it at kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And Denise and Fran are here. They are a part of the Old Mole, and they are Old Moles themselves. We are Old Moles together. And you yourself can be included in this amazing collective because of your listening, your participation, because you know this analysis hits you. And Denise, how did you get involved with KBOO? When did you start becoming a media maker?
Well, I actually was recruited, and I know that's sometimes a bad word, but
it's a wonderful thing.
It's a great word, right? Yeah, recruiting. We do. We recruit.
We reach out and grab people in the community and say, you've got something important to say.
This the Old Mole Variety Hour has been around for quite a long time. As some folks know, our Old Mole, Mr. Bill Resnick, was started the Old Mole Show, and it became the Old Mole Variety Hour. Jan Hawken, who's one of our longtime Old Moles, was a professor of mine at Portland State, and suggested we do some film reviews together and talk about film from a perspective that particularly Jan brought, which was psychoanalytic, and some of the film theory at the time, feminist film theory, was really becoming popularized and moving in all sorts of interesting directions. So we started to do film reviews together, and I was a student. I had never actually done radio, but I was in the theater department, so I felt like, well, if I can stand up in front of people live, I can do the radio. And that was back in the, God, I had to be in the early 90s.
Really, and early 90s,
yeah. And then I drifted away a little bit. And then since about 2004, I've been regularly contributing again to the Old Mole and KBOO. A couple times a month I do a show. So it's an awesome experience, and it keeps my brain sharp.
And your analysis helps to keep our brains sharp, too, because this is information we share. And that's the wonder of community radio. We do this thing together. We do it as listeners, as commentators, as people providing amazing music, as people providing poetry. It is a full-service community radio station and podcast hosting organization. We are the media, and we need your support to keep it going. So please do go to kboo.fm and help us continue to build a city of media makers. We have about 10 days left in our Kickstarter campaign, and we need you to share this information in your social media feeds so that we can reach that goal of $20,000. It's an all or nothing campaign. We need to raise about $10,000 in this last 10 days. So please, my friends, right now, go to Kickstarter. You can find it easily at kboo.fm/Kickstarter and share that information in your social media feeds. Encourage people to contribute and help KBOO build a city of media makers.
Well, our movie moles for today are here, as we know, Fran Michelle and Denise Morris, to talk about two movies coming to Portland, both films by women and about women. So, Denise?
And actually, I'm going to pass it over to Fran, who has our intros this morning on the two films we're going to talk about. Fran?
Yeah. In anticipation of Women's History Month and International Women's Day, we're going to be reviewing two independent documentaries by women and about women who were active in the liberation struggles of the 1970s. Both will be playing in Portland the weekend of March 9th and 10th. The Gentleman Bank Robber, the story of butch lesbian freedom fighter Rita Beau Brown, directed by Portland's own Julie Perini, is going to be playing at the Hollywood Theater Friday, March 9th at 7:30, and director will be present. The Gentleman Bank Robber is a portrait of revolutionary Rita Beau Brown, a white working class butch from rural Oregon who became known as the Gentleman Bank Robber in the 1970s for combining her butch style of dress with a polite way of demanding funds from bank tellers. And she was robbing banks partly to fund the George Jackson Brigade, the revolutionary prison abolitionist group which she was part of. Also that weekend, later that weekend, Left on Pearl is a documentary about the 1971 takeover and occupation of a Harvard University-owned building by hundreds of Boston-area women who set up a women's center in the building and demanded low-income housing for the community in which the building stood. That was directed by Susan Revo, and it plays as part of the Fifth Avenue Cinema International Women's Day program that weekend at the Fifth Avenue Cinema on Friday at 9. It's actually playing at 7, but if you do that, then you'll miss The Gentleman Bank Robber, and you don't want to do that. So Friday at 9 or Saturday the 10th at 7 and 9 or Sunday the 11th at 3 p.m. So these are both really interesting. They're both each about an hour long, less than an hour long, documentaries about activist women and about radical folks, about how people become politicized.
Right, Fran. And thank you for also helping people plan their social calendar. Another thing that KBOO offers. You're on to the pieces of these two films that I think are going to be most interesting to folks, which is they're a look at two different groups. One focuses on a much smaller group, the three people who were in the Pacific Northwest who were actually arrested for their actions to support the GJB, the George Jackson Brigade. And then Left on Pearl, which is a much larger collective action towards a goal. But both films deal with a lot of the same issues we're dealing with now: capitalism, imperialism, political repression, racism, mass incarceration, poverty, the need for adequate and available housing, issues that we would now call gentrification. And they both offer some very interesting insights into how people deal with political action in a militant way against a state that's largely repressive.
Yeah, I mean, in both of these films, we're looking at instances of people expropriating the expropriators, taking back something that is being used by or claimed by the wealthy, and using it for the purposes of making social change and improving people's lives and just going out and doing it. These are direct action films in various ways. They're also very similar in some ways. They're really different in some ways. I mean, they are both about these groups. Like, The Gentleman Bank Robber is not really about the George Jackson Brigade, which is a lesser-known second-wave radicalist militant movement that was in the Northwest and doesn't get the press of the Black Panther Party or the Weather Underground or
right.
other groups of the
time. It wasn't quite as glamorous,
no.
I think.
Yeah. No, it didn't have pretty people mm-hmm. of the sort that were more familiar.
Who became academics.
I mean, actually, a lot of the people in Left on Pearl are well-known today for having been academics. A lot of those people went on to become political scientists and architects and sociologists and mainstream politicians. So there's a kind of a bourgeois slant to it in that sense. I mean, it's about taking over a building, so it's not really that bourgeois. And one of the members is actually somebody who mentions having secretly been in the Weather Underground at the time of the takeover. But we don't hear about, like, how did she get in the Weather Underground and what was the story
right.
about that?
Right.
Although I would love to know that story, too. So, like, both of these films sort of spin off gestures toward other stories that we want to find out more about.
Right. And people can find out a little bit more about the George Jackson Brigade. You did some research. We should probably say, you know, Rita Beau Brown was kind of politicized by reading George Jackson's prison letters. And in fact, once she was in prison, and this is true of our Weather Underground subject as well, they both became very active in prison abolition movements.
Yeah, that's the important thing that prison teaches people who go there.
Right, that you need to destroy prisons.
Yes.
Yeah, right. But they're both really interesting films and in their own way. And one thing I will just mention about Left on Pearl is because it's a larger group of people, the film gets into some of the struggles that the women had once they all came together around common cause. They discovered that there were some uncommon causes that folks had to deal with, and that had to do with homosexuality. It had to do with the lesbian members of this action who were considered to be, you know, on the forefront of some of this militants. Many of them had already been active in gay liberation movements. So the film kind of doesn't present a kind of idealist view of those actions, but it does touch on some of the struggles and some of the...
Of the recruiting. Actually, I mean, yeah.
Well,
the stories are...
Well, there was recruiting there, too, yeah.
Like, oh, my God,
I'm a lesbian, yeah.
Maybe I'm a lesbian, like everybody else is doing.
And that, so in that sense, they're right about the women's movement, especially second wave, that everyone became lesbians. But not necessarily man-haters.
No, yeah. No. And actually not even all of them became
right.
Lesbians. Yeah.
No, not true.
There is
that.
A little clip of Betty Friedan mentioning the lesbian menace. And one of the people
right.
talks about, like, we thought this was a great idea. And we all got T-shirts that said lesbian
right.
menace.
Right. So we're joking, of course. But, of course, it's never so harmonious as to just come together around common cause. That there are some struggles and there's growth. And that's part of what I love about both of these films is that the films do touch on the process of becoming politically aware. And,
yeah.
And also, Gentleman Bank Robber really talks about a lot of the work around women, political prisoners, as well. So there's good stuff here.
Yeah. One of the lines about Gentleman Bank Robber in the sort of press information is that Bo Brown is a model of how to live a committed life as an activist and retain your humanity and sense of humor. And like, she's just a very appealing character. She just, you know, like, she seems great. You'd love mm-hmm. to hang out with her. I mean, that film is really focused on her more as an individual and follows her through the present. I mean, obviously the bulk of the film is devoted to her adventures as the gentleman bank robber, you know, the cuddly Marxist-Leninist people out to overthrow capitalism. But we get more of her later career, whereas in Left on Pearl, it's really about this one event, although we get little snippets at the end of, like, you know, what they did later and sort of following up with some of the figures who are interviewed in the film and the kinds of later activism that they were involved in.
Mm-hmm. And both in their own way deal with, I think, as I mentioned at the top, this kind of clash of militancy and the state. And in Left on Pearl, there's a section in there in which, at the point at which they're faced with the police coming in and forcibly removing them from the building, they have to decide whether or not the win that they have been given, so to speak, is enough for them to then walk away without anybody getting hurt. And these are real concerns for any group of people. The police aren't any more cuddly back then than they are. I mean,
they had less armor. I mean,
they had less armor.
Even though they talk about them coming in riot gear, the pictures you see, they're still wearing
right.
less than they're wearing
right.
today.
And now, on reflection, we see that the militarism of the police now, it puts this question of militancy and actions against a national security state, essentially, in perspective.
So people should definitely come out to see The Gentleman Bank Robber on Friday, March 9th, which is at the Hollywood as part of their March festival of films by about women and women's activism and that are chosen by women programmers.
It's called Feminist March.
Feminist March.
Feminist March 2018 is the Hollywood Theater series. And then the women's strike.
There's the women's strike on March 8th.
Right.
Feminism for the 99%. I think we're going to hear more about that on the Old Mole next week.
Right. Pioneer Square, March 8th at 4 o'clock.
And Left on Pearl, International Women's Day programming, the Friday, March 9th, 10th, 11th, to see that.
Excellent. Thank you, Fran.
Thank you, Fran and Denise. And that's a wrap for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Many thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest Sarah Chambers for their discussion of guns and schools, and to our movie moles for letting us know about a couple of films at least I certainly would not have heard about if it weren't for this show and KBOO. And thanks, as always, to our engineer, Patsy Kullberg. I'm Clayton Morgridge. I've been your host today. Join us again next Monday morning at 9 o'clock for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective. Today's show will be available on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, in a day or two if you want to hear it or any part of it or share it with your friends. And remember, KBOO's Kickstarter is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter.